Thank you, Robert. Thanks to the Kraski Forum. A very deep, heartfelt thanks to all of you for being here tonight. Having the privilege of addressing you from the podium of the Kraski Forum is more than an honor. It's a pleasure. And it's a pleasure because, unbeknownst to even the people of the Kraski Forum, the words Kraski in Austria play a significant role in my childhood and very early memories, because it was during the previous awful, hideous crisis of my country under the neo-fascist dictatorship, also known as the junta, that my family regularly sought refuge here in Austria during the summer. It's what my father used to refer to as our breathing month every July. So I have these memories, almost five summers consecutively, of spending time here. And I recall my parents discussing amongst themselves about that man, that great chancellor of Germany called... Germany. Sorry. It's a jet lag. Austria, Bruno Kreisky, who had set up a network, even while he was foreign minister, of solidarity to Greeks persecuted by the dictatorship. At the very same time that I'm expressing my pleasure for being here, in the context of the personal story that I related to you, there's also a distinct pain at the present state of affairs. Because let's not beat about the bush, let's be honest with one another. These days in my country, Austria does not have the image that it used to. Austria, for the average Greek, is thought of as a surplus country, shadowing the moves primarily of Germany in this drama that is the Euro crisis. And I'm sure that here in Austria too, the average Austrian hears the word Greek and immediately reaches for his or her pocket, thinking, oh my God, they will want money again. So Bruno Kreisky, what have we done to your legacy? We haven't been very good, have we? Greeks have at least produced a series of allegories and stories from ancient times which still have some currency in the world and in Europe. Unfortunately, even those metaphors and stories and tales and allegories and parables are used not always in the most effective and progressive of manners. Let me remind you of one such story, Aesop's fable of the ant and the grasshopper, as the English say. In southern Europe, it's another insect, but it doesn't matter. You will recall the story. The laborious, serious ant is working through the summer months, sweating away, while the grasshopper is playing its guitar or lyre under a tree, having a fun time, being exceptionally lazy and loving it. And then the winter comes and the ant has to bail the grasshopper out, so to speak. Of course, the fable has a deeper meaning, that neither the ant nor the grasshopper end up having a good life. So it's effectively a call for temperance on the part of Aesop. In Europe, after our own generation's 1929, because this is what 2008 was, the great financial sector collapse which led to a global crisis, a crisis which then translated into the steady fragmentation of the common currency. In 1929, the common currency, you may recall, was the gold standard. Now it's the Eurozone, it's the Euro. And then immediately after that, you have Nazis in parliament, which we do now in Greece. So the parallels are very close to what was going on in the 1930s. Immediately after such a financial sector collapse like 1929 or 2008, you have the utilization of fables like that by Aesop for their own purposes. So we have ended up in a situation now in Europe where the periphery, primarily the south plus Ireland, are being thought of in Northern Europe as the grasshopper, the collective grasshopper that overspent, overlazed, have too much of a good time during the good times, and now the winter of discontent is upon us, and the ants of the north will have to provide the sustenance which the silly, stupid grasshopper did not provide for himself. Now, this is the basic narrative. It sounds simple, but it is the basis of the European response to this Eurozone crisis. The whole notion of austerity plus loans, I will provide you with huge loans on condition that you tighten your belt and you stop being a grasshopper, is the essence of the way that we are dealing with this crisis. And it is my profound and deeply felt view that this is not only analytically false, but politically, socially, and economically catastrophic for the whole of Europe. If we need to stick to the Aesopian parable, we don't have to, but let's, for argument's sake, rephrase it or reformulate it. I would put it as follows. Before the crash of 2008, the grasshoppers of the south and the grasshoppers of the north coalesced into a unholy alliance against the ants of the north and the ants of the south. The grasshoppers of the north were the bankers of Frankfurt, plus some other bankers around the place, plus some other industrialists that coalesced with the bankers of the north to make a very large amount of money out of Ponzi growth investments in the south, with capital flows flooding the periphery, creating bubbles from which the grasshoppers of the south, our politicians, our developers, our bankers, and the grasshoppers of the north made a huge amount of money at the expense of diminishing real wages in Germany and in Greece amongst those who actually worked. And then when the bubble that was created in prior to 2008, to a very large extent due to the design of the Eurozone, when that bubble collapsed and burst, then again the grasshoppers of the south and the grasshoppers of the north formed a new alliance for the purposes of ensuring that it was the ants of the north and the ants of the south that would pay for that bubble. Let me put it very briefly, and then we can of course discuss this later. What is the Greek bailout? And if you want the Irish bailout, the Portuguese bailout, the bailouts now of Italy and Spain and so on and so forth. In the standard established narrative, especially in the north, it's an act of solidarity, European solidarity, towards the deficit countries. It is no such thing. What these bailouts were about was a transfer of losses from the books of the banks in Germany onto the German taxpayer and the Austrian taxpayer and the Dutch taxpayer and the Finnish taxpayer, the taxpayer of the surplus countries. This is all that happened. There was no solidarity with Ireland. There was no solidarity with Greece. There is being no solidarity with Spain as we speak. All that is happening is a very clever, almost seamless transfer of banking losses from the books of the Northern European banks, French and primarily German, to the books of the states of the North, and in particular the surplus countries. The worst culprit in all this, since I am addressing the Kreisky Forum, is the Social Democrats of Europe. We have to look at ourselves in the mirror and ask, I think, what is a poignant and pertinent question. Why have we fallen for this awful, misleading metaphor of the grasshopper and the ant? Once upon a time, Europe's Social Democrats knew well, as Kreisky knew, that capitalism is an accident-prone, crisis-generating system that cannot be trusted to produce prosperity. Once we knew that there are at least three markets within a market society that are hopelessly inefficient if left to their own devices, which are these three markets? Labor markets, financial markets, and the real estate markets. And if you allow these three markets to rule the roost, unimpeded and uncontrolled, what you're doing is you are effectively undermining capitalism itself. And capitalism, come to think of it, flourished during a period, the first post-war period, when there were enough progressives in power that were very skeptical about capitalism. So why have we lost our critical capacities in Europe? And particularly, why has the left capitulated to what will go down in history as a great fallacy and a great error? To answer this question, I think we need to go a bit further back. You see, Europe is the child of the post-war arrangement, which was itself the product of American design. A global plan was put in place in the late 1940s. It began at Bretton Woods in 1944, and was deployed after 1949 on the basis of a very simple idea that New Dealers, people in Washington who had experienced the Great Depression, worked out during the war as part of planning for a world in which America would be the dominant force and a world that they did not want to see slide back into another Great Depression, because they had experienced in their bones the grapes of wrath, as Steinbeck described them. The global plan that I'm referring to was based on this very simple idea. Capitalism requires a degree of predictability of exchange rates. If not fixed exchange rates, predictable exchange rates, so that trade can flourish. This we have known for ages. This was the reason why we had the gold standard before the Second World War. The gold standard was a common currency. It was like the euro of the period. But they also knew that if you simply bind disparate economies together by means of a common currency, whether it's the gold standard, the dollar, the euro, it doesn't matter, there are going to be tectonic shifts underneath that may cause this thing to break. Why? Because every currency union, whether it's Austria, Europe, or the world, or Germany for that matter, will always contain within itself deficit and surplus regions. If you look at the Austrian economy as comprising different regions, some of them are in chronic deficit with others, whereas others experience a chronic surplus with others. Like in the United States, California and Arizona, like in Britain, Yorkshire and London, like in Germany, East and West, there will always be deficit and surplus regions. Now, within a nation, you have a mechanism, an almost automatic mechanism, of recycling the surpluses to the deficit regions in order to keep the whole thing going. If you create a common currency area, like the gold standard back then, or the Eurozone now, unless you find a way of recycling the surpluses from the surplus regions to the deficit regions, there will come a moment when some naturally, spontaneously created crisis in the financial sector or in some sector of that economy is going to place the burden of adjustment onto the deficit regions. The deficit regions, the more indebted ones, will have to cut. By cutting, they reduce their income. By reducing their income, they reduce their purchases of goods from the surplus areas. The surplus areas go into recession. The whole thing becomes the disaster that we had in the 1930s. Soon you have Nazis in parliament. The New Dealers knew that. So when they recreated the gold standard in 1944, the so-called Bretton Woods system, which survived up until the 15th of August of 1971, they made sure that they would have a surplus recycling mechanism inbuilt into the world economy. They disagreed with one another as to how it would work. John Maynard Keynes famously proposed a well-established mechanism for doing this. The Americans said, no, we don't want one of those. It's our surpluses, we will recycle them the way we want. And they started with the Marshall Plan, but there was a similar plan in Japan. And then beyond the Marshall Plan, for 20 years, 70% of American profits were being sent to Europe and to Japan in order to recycle these profits so that Europe and Japan can develop sufficiently in order to be able to carry on purchasing American products, and therefore closing the loop. That was the essence of the golden era of capitalism. It had nothing to do with the free markets and everything to do with planning. Now, the tragedy was that that system could no longer survive after the end of the 1960s, early 1970s. Why? Because, as I said, it was predicated upon the premise that American surpluses would be recycled into Europe and Asia. But by the end of the 1960s, America no longer had a surplus. It had become a deficit country. So that system died. And what we had in its stead was a new surplus recycling mechanism that became in the 1970s. It was an audacious, unbalanced, unruly mechanism. It was not exactly planned. The conditions for its emergence were planned. But unlike Bretton Woods, it wasn't planned. Paul Volcker, who was a chairman of the Fed, appointed by President Carter, and then was instrumental in stabilizing inflation in the United States by means of very large increases in interest rates under Reagan, the early years of Reagan. As a younger man, in 1971, in a document that he produced for Henry Kissinger, before Kissinger became the foreign minister, State Department secretary in the United States, explained this new surplus recycling mechanism brilliantly in that paper. He said something very similar. How can the United States maintain its hegemony now that it no longer has a surplus? And the answer he gave, which was quite audacious and brilliant, was, it doesn't matter whether we have a surplus or not. What matters is that we recycle global surpluses. If we can't recycle our surpluses because we don't have any, we might as well recycle other people's surpluses. So if you look at the period between the mid-1970s and 2008, what you will see is a complete reversal of the system, global system, that prevailed between 1950 and 1971. Between 50 and 71, American surpluses were recycled internationally, in Europe and in Japan. Where did these surpluses come from? The Americans were selling, were exporting to Europe and to Japan, more than they were importing. So they had a surplus. And then they sent that surplus in the form of direct investment or indirect investment into Europe and Japan. After that, in the second period, which I use a Greek metaphor to relate it, I call it the global minotaur, but I won't bother you with it now, with the metaphor in itself. What we had was the opposite. The United States operated like a huge vacuum cleaner. It was sucking into the United States the net exports of Germany, of Austria, of France even, and of course Japan, and later, crucially, China. And the deficits were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The Americans didn't care. Unlike the Germans, they didn't say, oh, it's time to tighten our belt and eliminate our deficits. No. We will increase our deficits. The question, of course, is, if you're constantly increasing your deficits, who's going to pay for them? This is a question that Greeks are very aware of these days. The answer that the Americans gave was the rest of the world. And the rest of the world duly did. Again, that's it's not a coincidence, interesting similarity of numbers. 70% of German, Japanese, and later Chinese profits made as a result of exporting to the United States and to one another as a result of this engine of growth created by the American deficits, 70% of Europe's and Japan's and later China's profits ended up in Wall Street, Why? They were seeking better profits, returns. But in the process, they were closing the loop because they were paying for the growing American deficits. There was no plan there as such. American authorities jealously created the conditions in the United States so that this tsunami of capital would flow into Wall Street in order to finance the growing trade deficits of the United States, which were producing the demand for Mercedes-Benz, for Siemens, for French companies, for Chinese companies, for Sony and so on. What did they need to do in order to maintain this flow? They needed to ensure that capital flight into New York was profitable and more profitable than it would have been had it stayed in Frankfurt or in Paris or in Tokyo. That meant a squeeze of American wages to keep American inflation below the rate of inflation in Europe and Asia. Still in the United States, the median wage has not recovered to the level of 1972. Still, it's below the 1972 levels. Secondly, an energy policy that ensured that the rate of increase in energy prices for American companies was lower than it was in Europe. Thirdly, and very importantly, financialization. The deregulation of Wall Street was not a result of great greed. No, it's the other way around. Greed was a result of deregulation. Deregulation was important in order to attract that tsunami of capital to close the circle. And no rational argument against deregulation of the banking sector could come into the way of such a huge flow of dollars. The tragedy was that this created an unbalanced, bubble-based growth globally. Because, firstly, you had a race to the bottom. American wages were being squeezed. The model, if you remember, of Anglo-Saxon capitalism was being hailed on the basis of the flexibility of the labor market. What was that? It was just code for squeezing labor. And if the American wages were falling, Europe had somehow to respond. Mrs. Thatcher did this brilliantly. And then Mrs. Thatcher's ideas were exported so nicely to the rest of Europe. Slowly but gradually. This reduction in labor's remuneration meant that in order to keep up with oligopolistically induced relatively high prices, workers had to resort to the credit system, to financialization to make ends meet, both in the United States and increasingly here. And how could they do this? By using their houses as collateral. So you have financial markets beginning to rule over democracy, labor markets treating, being allowed by us, society, to treat labor as another commodity and not as a special commodity like we used to think here in Europe, especially as under the influence of social democratic thinking. And finally, reliance on growth on real estate. It was as if the devil had tried to design a system that would do two things. It would remove the shock absorbers, and secondly, ensure that when the shock happens, it is greater than ever. And that shock came in 2008. And the reason why it came was because this tsunami of capital into the United States of America, your money, money from Europe, from Japan, from China, amounted to something between $3 and $5 billion net every day. That's quite a lot of money to give to bankers every day, even if they only keep it for 10 minutes a day. What does a banker do if you give him, usually him or her, $3 to $5 billion a day to play with? They make it grow for themselves. They will find ways of making it hatching, you know. This is the Aristotelian notion of money, that money breeds. And how did that happen? Through financialization. What were all these fancy acronyms? CDOs, CDSs, CDO squares, swaps, options, and so on and so forth. They were new forms of debt. That's what it was. They were very fancy and technically extremely complicated, but the essence of it was that they were new instruments of debt, the purpose of which was through trading them amongst each other, the bankers, they would use them as a form of money. Because what's money? Money is a piece of paper that you use for exchange purposes and as a store of value. That's what money is. Well, those CDOs and options and pieces of paper started acquiring all the properties of money. So it was as if Wall Street was given the printing press. At a time when monetarism ruled supreme and central banks here in Europe, in the United States, everywhere, adopted the mantle that we should not print money. Yeah. You've heard of this? Yeah? The bankers were given the right to print as much as they wanted. They didn't call it money, but it was money. Just to give you an idea, in 1999, world income, global income, global GDP, was something in the order of 48 trillion. Just think of 48. There are too many zeros to worry about after that. 48, right? The total worth of these derivatives was about 50 in 1999. In 2007, global income have increased from 49 to almost 70. Right? 49 to 70. Courtesy of developments in Asia and so on and so forth. And high growth in Europe and elsewhere. Do you know what the size of the bundle of derivatives in value was? Remember, it was 50 in 1999 compared to 48 of GDP. In 2007, we had GDP was 70. Derivatives were 785. Planet Earth was just not large enough to contain them. So like a huge pyramid, it collapsed. And that was 2008. The tragedy is that when you have such a massive catastrophe in the financial sector, this is what we Greeks refer to as nemesis that follows from hubris. When you have such a financial sector collapse, the world, real men and women, suffer. It's not just paper burning. Just like in 1929. When you have such a financial sector collapse, capital flows are reversed. In the Eurozone, throughout that period, 1999 to 2007, you had massive flows of capital, of money. Toxic, private, public, doesn't matter, money. Flowing into the real estate market in Spain, Ireland, in the public sector of Greece. Why was it flowing? Because in the metropolis, in the centers of financialized capitalism, interest rates were so low those who actually were producing this money could not get sufficiently high returns for them. So they had to spread the tentacles of that financialized beast in areas where they would get higher returns because there would be more risky investments and so on and so forth. So those huge bubbles that were created in Ireland, in Spain, in Greece, and so on, suddenly burst because where the capital withdrew like a vicious tide following the implosion of the of global finance, then you have catastrophes in the periphery. Let me put it very simply. The Eurozone was constructed on the assumption, the false assumption, that this surplus recycling mechanism that Paul Volcker had described back in 1971, and which kept the industries of Europe, of Northern Europe, humming nicely away because demand was looked after by this beast of the surplus recycling mechanism, what I call the global minotaur. The assumption was that that would go on forever. That Europe, and especially the surplus parts of Europe, would not have to worry about where demand for their goods would come. So, the gleaming factories in this part of the world, north of the Alps and east of the Rhine, if you want, only had to worry about how to produce good stuff efficiently. And that they did. brilliantly. They did not have to worry about where would customers find the money to buy those gleaming new cars, capital goods in China, and so on and so forth, because it was America that was providing the requisite demand for these goods through this surplus recycling. But when that surplus recycling broke down and it died in 2008, it was just a natural result that suddenly demand was not there to be taken for granted. The Eurozone was built on the assumption that you can create a gold standard, remember the gold standard? In Europe, within the Eurozone, binding together on the basis of effectively the most fixed of fixed exchange rates are disparate economies, without a surplus recycling mechanism within the Eurozone, because the Americans were doing it for us. And when the Americans no longer did it for us, because they couldn't, because they went under, and all they tried managed to do was to salvage Wall Street through a bailout of the bankers, suddenly the Eurozone began fragmenting. It's what happens when you build a nice big building without good foundations. It's fine until the earthquake hits. When the earthquake hits, you think, oh my God, it starts unraveling. And of course, the first part of the first crack will emerge in the flimsiest part of the building. It was Greece. Have you noticed I haven't said a word about Greece so far? It was Greece, because it's not significant. Greece is not important. It is for Greeks, but it's not important in understanding what's going on. The fact that Greece has been monopolizing the headlines for 3 years shows that there's something profoundly wrong with capitalism, not with Greece. Because if, this is what I tell my friends in America, if the great state of Delaware could induce a crisis that brings the United States down, there's something wrong with, not with Delaware, but with the United States of America. If Greece could create all these huge problems for Europe, this is a problem with the design of our European institutions and economies. So it started there. Let's say that in 1999, the Tsimidis government in Greece has chosen not to apply for membership into the Eurozone. Would we be talking about Greece now? No. Greece would have had a relatively mild recession in 2008, and now would be growing again. It would have its malignancies, its problems, its corruption, but it would not be an issue. You would not be reading about it in the Financial Times. Would the Eurozone still be having difficulties? Absolutely. It would be having exactly the same difficulties. But instead of talking about Greece and having a summit and a Eurogroup meeting for Greece, you would have it for Italy. Or you would have it for Ireland, as we did. The problem with the Eurozone was that it was like a fine riverboat that was asked to cross the Atlantic. One day, 2 days, 3 days of great weather, it is sailing beautifully. Then the storm hits and it starts sinking. When the crash happened, moving away again from Greece, because I'm not interested in discussing the snowflake that caused the avalanche. Even if you remove the snowflake that starts the avalanche will happen, it's got to do with the structure of the mountain and the weight distribution of the snow. When the crash happened, both in the United States and in Europe, we had a magnificent and pretty hideous development. The end of capitalism as we know it. This sounds like a megalomaniac statement, but I truly believe in it. In 1991, communism collapsed. And with it, the left, even the social democratic left, went into a tailspin. In 2008, we had exactly the same collapse of capitalism. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, when I was, you know, beginning to participate in the political debates from the left perspective that I had, I remember the great debates between us left-wingers and the right-wingers were on the basis of an intellectual argument about the merits of capitalism, of free markets, versus the merits of planning, of planned economies. The proponents of free market capitalism, Hayekians, proponents of von Mises, since we're in Vienna, would argue that planning is doomed to fail because of the aggregation problem. It's impossible to know what people want. There's so much information, it is impossible even for a well-meaning bureaucrat to aggregate it all, to aggregate information on what people want and what their capacities are. And the only way of coordinating activity is through market signals. And if you allow market signals to operate without being frustrated by collective action, by bureaucracies, by states, then you are going to end up with a social Darwinian process that weeds out the inefficient and selects for the successful companies, the ones who actually provide things that people want. That was the argument on the right. The argument on the left was that markets, especially the markets that I mentioned before, financial markets, labor markets, and real estate markets, have a tendency, if you leave them to their own devices, to trip and fall on their faces and not be able to get up, with massive human costs for everyone, and including costs for the efficient companies that liberals are so keen to see being promoted. So these were the arguments that we were having. I don't know, perhaps, you know, you recall those arguments, right? Well, what has happened since 2008? We have the reverse of a Darwinian process. The more bankrupt you are, the greater your capacity to extract economic value from the rest. Especially if you're a banker. I call the new regime we live in, not capitalism, but bankruptocracy. Not bankocracy, bankruptocracy. Rule by bankrupt banks. Banks whose capacity to extract surplus from the rest of society, both from capital, industrial capital, and from labor, is an increasing proportion of their losses. These are the people who are running Europe today and the United States. But in Europe, we have some degree of a greater problem than the United States does because of the bad design of the Eurozone. Now, in the 1930s, in the Great Depression, we had the Dust Bowls, we had immense suffering, we had the Grapes of Wrath, which I mentioned before, but you didn't have the specter of continental disintegration. You didn't have people in California saying, these people in Missouri, my God, we better get rid of them from the Union. Missouri was the Greece of the United States, permanent bailout, right? And yet you didn't have this kind of fragmentation. There are, of course, historical, national, cultural reasons for that. In Europe, because of the way the architecture of the Eurozone was put together, it was inevitable that the moment this 2008 crash, our generation's 1929, began, that you would have sequential insolvencies of banking sectors and states. Why? Because in our infinite wisdom, we band together our economies, single currency but different banking sectors. The banking sector of Greece depends on the Greek state for times of trouble. The banking sector of Austria depends on the state of Austria, and so on and so on. Imagine what would have happened in 2008 when the financial sector was collapsing. If the good state of Nevada had to bail out the banks of Nevada, can I tell you what would happen? Both the state of Nevada and the banks of Nevada would go bankrupt. And then the domino effect would start. Imagine, forget Nevada, the New York state. If the state of New York had to bail out Wall Street, like Ireland had to bail out its banks, there would be no state of New York today. It would be in a state worse than Greece. So this is the architecture that we created. Now, why did we allow this to happen? Why did the European left, in particular, allow this to happen? The left that built its traditions on a good, thorough understanding of what went wrong in the 1930s. Things that Bruno Kreisky would have known in his sleep. Why has the democratic left of the 1990s and 2000s allowed itself to be so badly taken in? It is because, firstly, the sound of money chimed very nicely in their ears. And I don't mean this in a corrupt way, that they were corrupt. No. The great tsunamis of capital that were going from Europe to Wall Street, producing this toxic money, which was then coming back into Europe and flooding the place, made them feel they got this delusion. It wasn't even an illusion, it was a delusion. That they could finance social democratic projects, if in power, by tapping into this financialization process, by becoming part of it. But to become part of it, they had to surrender their soul to this particular Mephistopheles, which they did. And to a very large extent, they did fund a lot of good programs on the basis of that. In Britain, for instance, the Blair Brown government, however despicable it might have been for other reasons, think of Iraq, they did increase expenditure on health, on education, massively, on the basis of tapping into the financialization of the City of London. But once that pyramid of money burned down, what were they left with? No ideological model in their minds that could challenge capitalism, financialize capitalism, and then challenge bankruptocracy. Bailouts today are not an act of solidarity. They are not an extension of Kreisky's vision within Europe. They are an extension of what my friend Jamie Galbraith discusses as a predator state populated by politicians that have a very cozy relationship with the bankrupt bankers, whose number one priority is how, as I said at the beginning of my talk, to shift private losses from their books onto the taxpayers of Germany, of Austria, and then to tell them that their hardship is due to the lazy Greeks, while telling the Greeks that it is the Nazi Germans' fault. And then, just like it happened in the 1930s, first you have a Wall Street collapse, then you have a real economy capitalist crisis, soon after that you have Nazis in parliament, you have the Germans blaming the Greeks blaming the Germans. In the next year or so, the Germans will start blaming the Germans, and the Greeks are already blaming the Greeks anyway. I shall finish by simply saying that it is our moral duty, not just our political duty, in Europe, to challenge the established narrative, to expose it for what it is. Because the way we are pursuing these bailout strategies now in Europe, we're just adding fuel to the fire. The Eurozone represents 30% of the global economy. Following our generation's 1929, the world is going to be experiencing a postmodern 1930s, already is. If we do not challenge the currently dominant narrative, Europe is perfectly capable, for a third time in 100 years, of dragging the global, the planet's economy into the quagmire of a 1930s-style depression. And it will be on the conscience of the Social Democrats of Europe that we were standing idly by, trying to become acceptable in the ranks of polite society. Lastly, I heard Mrs. Merkel yesterday celebrate her triumphant re-election as head of the CDU. And she said something that really struck me. She congratulated her government for having managed the euro crisis so nicely. And the evidence that she presented to support that claim was that Germany is doing much better than the rest of Europe. That the crisis has not hit Germany the way it has hit other places. And I'm sure that this is something that echoes here in Austria as well. This is a little bit like the first-class passengers of the Titanic celebrating The fact that they are still dry while the third-class passengers are drowning below. It is idiocy at a planetary scale. Thank you.